Akatra Foundation presents The Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're diving into a story that, honestly, it reads like a thriller, a really meticulously researched one, but tragically, it's all too real.
Mm-hmm.
It's this saga of just extraordinary ambition, immense wealth, and a public health crisis that has profoundly impacted millions of lives, mainly across America.
Yeah, it's staggering.
We're talking about Empire of Pain by Patrick Radden Keefe. It's a deep dive into the Sackler family, you know, the dynasty behind Purdue Pharma and that notorious painkiller, OxyContin.
Right. And what's truly fascinating here, I think, is how Keefe's central thesis really reframes the whole American opioid crisis.
Yeah.
He doesn't present it as some unfortunate accident or, you know, an unforeseen consequence, but rather as a direct, calculated result of this one family's relentless, almost single-minded pursuit of fortune. It's quite a sweeping indictment, really.
It really is.
Yeah, of how immense wealth combined with sophisticated legal power and this carefully curated public image can basically be weaponized.
Weaponized, that's the word.
Yeah, to downplay addiction, to corrupt parts of the medical establishment, manipulate regulatory bodies, all while generating billions from, well, widespread suffering.
So our mission today, as we explore these sources Keefe lays out, is to try and unravel how this crisis, this thing of such magnitude, even began.
Mm-hmm.
To understand who Keefe identifies as responsible, and importantly, to extract the profound lessons it holds for all of us. Lessons about corporate responsibility, that often blurry line between medicine and marketing.
Oh, definitely blurry.
And just the very nature of accountability in our society today. So get ready, because the insights from the story are, they're truly an eye-opener.
Absolutely.
Okay, so to really get the Sackler dynasty, you kind of have to rewind, right? Go back to the beginning, to the patriarch, Arthur Sackler.
Right, Arthur.
Born to Jewish immigrants in Brooklyn, his early life, it seems, was marked by this really fierce desire to escape poverty, make his mark. And he was, by all accounts, a genuine polymath, a doctor, a publisher, and crucially, an advertising mogul.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where Keefe reveals something really interesting. His most impactful genius wasn't just in medicine itself. It was in revolutionizing, maybe even kind of inventing, how pharmaceuticals were sold.
Exactly. Arthur's true innovation, it seems, lay in acquiring this small ad agency, William Douglas McAdams.
Right.
And transforming it into a powerhouse, one dedicated exclusively to pharmaceutical advertising. He pioneered techniques that, well, they're industry standards now.
It's things we see everywhere.
Yeah, techniques that fundamentally shifted the relationship between drug companies and doctors.
Yeah.
He aggressively targeted physicians directly, used medical journals, ones he owned, to subtly promote his clients' drugs.
Wow.
And enlisted prominent physicians as paid spokespeople, often without, you know, full disclosure.
Yeah.
Think about his groundbreaking campaign for Roche's tranquilizers, Valium and Librium.
Huge drugs.
Massive. And he didn't just market Valium for, say, severe clinical anxiety. He expanded its scope, marketed it for the everyday stresses of modern life. He effectively created a market for a lifestyle drug.
So not just treating illness, but creating a need.
Precisely. This unprecedented campaign made Valium the first ever drug to hit $100 million in annual sales. And it lay the undeniable blueprint for everything that would follow. It taught the pharmaceutical industry how to, well, manufacture demand for drugs, not just meet existing medical needs.
So Arthur Sackler, he died in 1987, right? That's well before OxyContin even existed.
Mm-hmm. Long before.
Yet Keefe's argument, the core of it, is that his ethos, this profit above all else, aggressive marketing, and this willingness to blur the ethical lines between real medicine and just pure marketing, that became the foundational sin, as Keefe calls it, for the whole family enterprise.
Yeah, that's the term he uses.
He famously believed that the art of pharmaceutical marketing is the art of inspiring confidence, and that very confidence, that trust, it would later be weaponized with just catastrophic results.
A chilling thought, given what happened.
So Arthur lays this marketing groundwork, but how did this foundational sin, how did it escalate from tranquilizers like Valium to a drug that would just engulf an entire nation in crisis?
Right. The leap is huge.
Let's turn our attention then to his younger brothers, Mortimer and Raymond. They acquired a small, pretty unassuming company called Purdue Frederick.
It became Purdue Pharma.
Exactly. Eventually became Purdue Pharma. And for decades, it was, you know, modest, small player. But then came MS Contin.
Ah, yes, MS Contin.
A slow-release morphine pill, mainly for cancer patients. And this drug introduced the content time release system, which, as you might guess, became absolutely critical for their next much bigger play.
That's right. As the patent for MS Contin started nearing its expiration date, Raymond's son, Richard Sackler, really emerged as the driving force. He was the one pushing for a new blockbuster.
Richard Sackler, he's central to this part of the story.
Absolutely central. They seized upon oxycodone, which is a semi-synthetic opioid, known to be significantly more potent than even morphine.
More potent than morphine.
Yeah. And then they married it with that Contin delivery system from MS Contin. And this was the genesis of OxyContin, launched in 1996. And the book, it really paints Richard Sackler as this utterly central figure, micromanaging every single aspect of the launch, the marketing, everything. He was even quoted as saying something like, the launch of OxyContin will be followed by a blizzard of prescriptions that will bury the competition.
A blizzard? Wow. That's chillingly prophetic, isn't it?
It really is, considering the scale of what was unleashed.
Okay, here's where the story gets, truly disturbing. The entire marketing strategy for OxyContin, according to Keefe, was built on this monumental falsehood.
The less than 1% lie.
Exactly. Purdue claimed the drug was less than 1% addictive because of its slow-release formula, and this claim, it was based on a single, flimsy, totally out-of-context citation, like a letter to the editor in a medical journal.
Unbelievable, isn't it? Just a letter.
But how on earth did they get that past the regulators, the FDA?
Well, Keefe meticulously details how Purdue targeted a specific FDA examiner, Dr. Curtis Wright.
Okay.
He approved an unprecedented package insert that included this less than 1% claim. And then get this, within 2 years.
Let me guess.
Dr. Wright took a high-paying executive job at Purdue Pharma.
Oh, come on. That's not just a coincidence. That's the definition of the revolving door, right?
It's a textbook example, absolutely. Mm. Where former government regulators take these lucrative positions in the very industries they once oversaw. It raises profound questions about conflicts of interest.
So Keith suggests Purdue didn't just find a loophole. They actively worked this angle.
It seems so. Keith suggests that Purdue didn't just exploit existing vulnerabilities in the regulatory system, but actively cultivated relationships to ensure favorable outcomes. That less than 1% claim, despite having basically no clinical data to support it,
none,
allowed them to market OxyContin, not just for severe cancer pain, which is MS Contin's territory, but for a much, much broader range of moderate pain.
Yeah.
This dramatically expanded its potential market.
So opening the floodgates.
Exactly. That FDA approval was the key that unlocked what Keefe describes as the most aggressive pharmaceutical marketing campaign in history.
Yeah.
Purdue doubled its sales force.
Doubled it.
And incentivized them with enormous bonuses. We're talking six-figure bonuses for individual reps.
Wow.
Specifically targeting high-prescribing doctors, particularly in vulnerable regions like Appalachia, where you had high rates of chronic pain and economic hardship already.
A perfect storm, almost.
It really was, and they didn't stop there. They funded so-called pain advocacy groups, effectively creating this groundswell of demand by promoting the idea of pain as the fifth vital sign.
Ah, I remember hearing that phrase.
Yeah, it was everywhere. A call to treat pain aggressively, and the answer implicitly was OxyContin. They even distributed branded swag fishing hats, plush toys, CDs with relaxation music, all with the OxyContin name, making it seem almost benign.
Like it's just another product.
Precisely. And sales skyrocketed, of course. But so did the reports of addiction, crime, overdose deaths.
The inevitable consequence.
Right. And the tragic irony, which Keefe argues Purdue knew and concealed, was that the very slow release mechanism, the thing supposed to make it safer, could be easily defeated just by crushing the pills. This gave abusers an immediate, powerful, heroin-like high. Internal documents later showed Purdue was aware of this abuse as early as 1997.
1997, so almost right away.
Almost immediately.
Yes.
Yet they actively suppressed this information for years, continuing to promote the drug as safe and non-addictive.
That's just staggering. So as the death toll mounted, this devastating public health crisis unfolded. Keefe then shifts the narrative, right, to the aftermath, the first attempts at accountability.
Yes, the fallout. Early legal challenges led to a 2007 plea deal. Purdue executives pleaded guilty to misdemeanor misbranding charges.
Misdemeanor.
And the company paid a $634 million fine. But critically, no Sackler family member was charged personally.
No individuals from the family.
No. And the family reportedly saw the fine as, well, just the cost of doing business. They continued to pocket billions while denying any personal culpability for the unfolding tragedy.
Just a business expense. Meanwhile,
the crisis deepens. And the book's portrayal of the family's internal mindset during this time is particularly chilling.
How so?
Well, uncovered internal emails reveal Richard Sackler, for instance, blaming the victims directly, referring to them with derogatory terms like scum and criminals.
Seriously, scum?
Yes. He argued, and this is a quote, Keefe includes, "We have to hammer on the abusers in every way possible. They are the culprits and the problem. They are reckless criminals."
Wow. The lack of remorse? The deflection?
It's utter. A complete lack of remorse and this consistent projection of blame. It's truly disturbing. And simultaneously, while the crisis raged, the Sacklers engaged in what Keefe powerfully describes as reputation laundering.
Reputation laundering, explain that.
Using their billions in money made from OxyContin to endow prestigious wings at world-renowned museums. The Met, the Louvre.
Right, I've seen the Sackler ring signs.
Exactly. And at universities like Harvard and Yale, Keefe notes the family's name was seemingly on everything but the pill bottles.
A deliberate strategy.
A very deliberate strategic move to build this firewall between their public image as philanthropists and the true devastating source of their immense wealth.
But that armor, you know, built through philanthropy and legal teams, it eventually started to crack, didn't it?
It did. Keefe highlights the tireless efforts of journalists like himself, along with dedicated lawyers, state attorneys, generals, people who just refused to let the story die.
The pressure mounted.
Yes. And a significant turning point came with the artist activist Nan Golden.
Ah, Nan Golden, yes.
A recovering OxyContin addict herself. She founded PAIN, Prescription Addiction Intervention Now, and staged these incredibly high-profile die-ins.
Right, in the museums.
In the very museums bearing the Sackler name. Her visceral, direct action, confronting the family's perceived benevolence head-on. It proved to be an incredibly effective strategy. It finally started shredding that philanthropic shield.
That must have been powerful.
Her activism was absolutely pivotal. Facing thousands of lawsuits and just overwhelming public disgrace, institutions finally began to distance themselves. The Louvre removed the Sackler name from its galleries.
They took it down.
Tufts University stripped the name from its campus buildings. And then in 2019, Purdue Pharma filed for bankruptcy.
The end of the company, basically.
Well, yes and no. It was a highly complex legal maneuver that, while it effectively ended the company as it was known, was largely seen as a strategy to shield the family's remaining personal fortune from further lawsuits.
Ah, so protect their personal wealth.
Exactly. So while their name is now, for many, synonymous with corporate malfeasance and their company is destroyed, the book concludes that their vast personal wealth, estimated in the billions, remains largely intact.
Still billionaires.
Highlighting what Keefe views as the profound limits and maybe frustrations of American justice in cases like this.
So, stepping back, what does this all mean for you, the listener? This isn't just some historical account of one super powerful family, is it?
Not at all.
It feels like a really powerful and immediate lesson in how unchecked power, when coupled with unbridled greed, can systematically erode the very foundations of trust. Trust in critical institutions, the ones meant to protect public health and safety.
Absolutely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the book serves as a damning indictment of systemic failures across multiple fronts.
Like what?
Well, the FDA, for instance, appears understaffed, under-resourced, and critically susceptible to industry manipulation.
The revolving door we talked about?
Precisely. The Department of Justice is portrayed as pulling its punches, you know, opting for those misdemeanor charges against the company, rather than pursuing individuals potentially responsible for a national catastrophe.
Yeah.
It's a tragic case study, really, in the profound corruption of science and medicine by commerce.
Yeah.
Where the profit motive just completely subverted the ethical foundations of medicine. The Sacklers didn't just sell a drug.
No, they sold an idea.
They aggressively marketed and sold a whole new philosophy of pain management, one that perfectly served their financial interests, not necessarily the patient's best outcome. It's a compelling illustration of that complex relationship between individual motivations and systemic impact.
How people get caught up in it.
Yeah. How even initially well-intentioned people can become deeply complicit in really harmful systems through a mix of self-interest, rationalization, and just gradual ethical compromise. Little steps down a bad path.
And the Sacklers, they understood power, especially the power of narrative, didn't they?
Oh, better than most.
Yeah.
Whoever controls the narrative often wins. For decades, they meticulously used their vast legal and PR teams to suppress negative stories, to intimidate journalists, to shape public perception.
Until it broke.
Their downfall, or at least the significant tarnishing of their legacy, only really came when a more powerful, truthful narrative tirelessly pushed by activists, victims, investigative journalists finally broke through that carefully constructed wall.
Which makes you ask, right? How much responsibility do we have as citizens to question what we're told, especially in critical areas like our healthcare system?
That's a crucial point. And it raises another important question. What about the millions of victims of this crisis?
Yeah.
By meticulously detailing how the opioid crisis was manufactured by corporate greed, the book helps dismantle that harmful stigma, the idea that addiction is simply a moral failing.
It wasn't just bad choices by individuals.
No, it shows how millions of ordinary Americans were led into addiction by a medical system they trusted, guided by this incredibly unscrupulous marketing. And, you know, for those interested in the broader world of philanthropy.
Right, the museum wings.
The Sackler story forces a really critical reevaluation. Does the good done by a donation truly outweigh the profound harm done to acquire that money? Should respected institutions accept what some now call tainted money? Where do you draw that line?
Really tough questions. Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive into Empire of Pain, let's pull out some core takeaways for you. First, maybe an emotional insight. It's the tragedy, really, of corrupted intentions. How genuine medical ambitions, or at least the appearance of them, can slowly, almost imperceptibly, transform into this destructive pursuit of profit. It illustrates how people, through incremental ethical compromises, maybe competitive pressures, can become complicit in immense harm.
Mm-hmm. The slippery slope. Second, perhaps an intellectual insight. It's about the systematic nature of these corporate accountability failures. Keefe reveals it's rarely just about a few bad actors.
It's the system.
It's often about how the regulatory, legal, cultural, and economic systems themselves fail or have weaknesses, allowing powerful entities to manipulate and exploit those weaknesses, sometimes for devastating gain.
And finally, a universal insight. I think it's the critical importance of moral courage in professional life. Throughout the Sackler story, Keefe points to moments where self-correction was possible.
Opportunities missed.
Exactly. Yet competitive pressures, overwhelming financial incentives, they consistently seemed to prevent actions that might have reduced or maybe even averted this catastrophic harm.
Yeah. The Sackler's name is now, for many people, completely synonymous with corporate malfeasance and the opioid crisis. Yet, as the deep dive concludes, their vast personal fortune remains largely intact, mostly untouched by criminal charges.
Still there.
It leaves us with this stark reminder. Societal catastrophes are rarely purely accidental. They are often the cumulative result of deliberate choices, of strategic omissions, and sometimes of relentless pursuit of profit over people. The journey to true accountability is often long, it's arduous, and frustratingly incomplete. It really prompts us to consider, what are you willing to question in your own life, in society, and what systems are you willing to challenge to ensure that justice, in all its forms, ultimately prevails?
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by ECATRA Foundation.